Please open your books, your Bibles, to the book of Proverbs. For those who have read through the book of Proverbs before, you'll recognize that the first seven chapters or so are instructions that are often preceded by a statement such as we find in verse 8 of Proverbs chapter 1. My son, hear the instruction of your father and do not forsake the law of your mother. Or as we jump on down to chapter 2 in verse 1. My son, if you receive my words and treasure my commands within you. And he goes on from that point forward. Or in chapter 3 and verse 1. My son, do not forget my law, but let your heart keep my commands. Or verse 11. My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor detest his correction. Or in verse 21, my son, let them not depart from your eyes. Keep sound wisdom and discretion. In chapter 4 and verse 1, hear, my children, the instruction of a father and give attention to understanding. Or in verse 10, hear, my son, and receive my sayings, and the years of your life will be many. Or verse 20, my son, give attention to my words, incline your ear to my sayings. Verse 1 of chapter 5, my son, pay attention to my wisdom, lend your ear to my understanding. He says in verse 7, therefore hear me now, my children, and do not depart from the words of my mouth. Chapter 6, verse 1. My son, if you become surety for your friend, if you have shaken hands and a pledge for a stranger, and he goes on from that point forward. Verse 20, my son, keep your father's command and do not forsake the law of your mother. Chapter 7, verse 1, my son, keep my words and treasure my commands within you. And then, sure, there's a few that I missed as I was quickly skimming over those chapters to illustrate. What is this about? These are instructions from a father to a son. And this is important that parents, as we talked about, have talked about for the last two nights, see that this is their primary role, to impart wisdom to the next generation, to their children. I suppose you could see this lesson is in keeping with the theme that is going to be taking place for the next 5-6 weeks here on Thursday nights. You see, we live in a sex-saturated society. And daily and sometimes hourly, we are confronted with voices and images through the various media. And one begins to wonder if there is any earthly sanctuary from this onslaught. Even the potentially strong defenses of the home have been breached by cable, internet, telephone, radio waves, which are often carriers of sensuality and perversion. It's not the technology that's the problem, it's what the technology is being used for. And even if you think personally that you can handle it, that you are not, that you are somehow immune to these infections, your children and your grandchildren, as we talked about last night, are not. And that this is true is easily illustrated in their attitudes, the attitudes that we see them manifesting in their conversations, the things that they are talking about, the things that are important to them, the way they adorn their rooms, the idols, the heroes with which they festoon, the very places that they sequester themselves for hours during a day, the way they adorn themselves, and the choices they are making in their young lives, it is evident that our culture is having an impact. And while the technology, as I've already said, that is used to inflame our basest impulses and supply them virtual instant gratification is relatively new, this technology is relatively new, the seductive power of temptation is nothing new. Indeed, God's Word has much to say. As I introduced things last Saturday night on the subjects of the sensual and the sexual. And we are not surprised, brethren, that the worldly have very little tolerance or patience for these scriptural warnings that we're going to look at this evening. But as God's people, we had better take heed. Now the key text for our lesson this evening is Proverbs chapter 7. Please turn to Proverbs chapter 7. We're going to begin reading at verse 6. Proverbs 7, beginning with verse 6. A simple reading of this text is itself graphic in nature. Its explanation and its application may be necessarily more so. In this reading that we are about to engage in, we are going to observe what I'm going to call the anatomy of seduction. Perhaps you would prefer that we not discuss such things. But if we fail to confront the sensuality of this present world with the bluntness of Scripture, then we are effectively laying down our swords in surrender to the flesh that will enslave us, and if not us, our children and our children's children. Proverbs 7, verse 6. For at the window of my house I looked through my lattice. I saw among the simple, I perceived among the youths, a young man devoid of understanding, passing along the street near her corner. And he took the path to her house in the twilight, in the evening, in the black and dark night. And there a woman met him with the attire of a harlot and a crafty heart. She was loud and rebellious. Her feet would not stay at home. At times she was outside, at times in the open square, lurking at every corner. So she caught him and kissed him. With an impudent face, she said to him, I have peace offerings with me. Today I have paid my vows. So I came out to meet you, diligently, to seek your face. And I have found you. I have spread my bed with tapestry, colored coverings of Egyptian linen. I have perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. Come, let us take our fill of love until morning. Let us delight ourselves with love. For my husband is not at home. He has gone on a long journey. He has taken a bag of money with him and will come home on the appointed day. With her enticing speech, she caused him to yield. With her flattering lips, she seduced him. Immediately, he went after her, as an ox goes to the slaughter or as a fool to the correction of the stocks. Till an arrow struck his liver, as a bird hastens to the snare, he did not know it would take his life. What we have here is a description, an inspired description, given to us that we need to consider. And we have two primary characters in this story. First of all, we have a seductress. We're told here that this seductress wore the attire of a harlot. The text does not say that this woman was a harlot, that is, a harlot by profession. But she was certainly playing the harlot. And that's phraseology that is used in the Old Testament, frequently in reference to the children of Israel and their relationship with God. As a society, as a culture, we have rightly condemned the behavior of those who degrade themselves by renting their bodies for sexual use. But it is quite inconsistent to condemn the harlot and not condemn the one who plays the harlot. You see, the sin of harlotry is not the money involved. It's the fornication. The woman who gives her body to another outside of the commitment of marriage, as we have been saying, designed by God, for any reason, who gives her body outside of marriage for any reason, money, as we typically associate with prostitution, prestige, popularity, selfishness, rebellion, curiosity, for any reason, is playing the harlot. Now, the text here, as we read about this seductress, as she, we're told that she wears the attire of a harlot, but the text does not define for us the attire of a harlot. You might, in your own imagination, think of a stereotypical attire of a harlot, but we're not told. The point is that she was advertising herself and her availability by what she wore. Her outward adornment communicated something to men. It communicated a readiness, a willingness. Now, the New Testament is quite clear that the godly woman will not choose to adorn herself with the attire of a harlot. She will not choose to dress herself in such a way. Let's just look at two texts that I'm sure you've looked at before. But in this context, let's give them a little bit more consideration. In 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 9. 1 Timothy chapter 2, beginning with verse 9. Paul writes, "In like manner also that the women adorn themselves in modest apparel with propriety and moderation, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly clothing, but which is proper for women professing godliness with good works." So here Paul calls for dress among women that is decent and worn with a sense of shame, with self-control. You see, of more concern to godly women, and that's who he's speaking to here, women who are going to profess godliness, of more concern should be things like godliness and good works. But again, how much time is spent in primping the outer person with the mirror and the makeup and the changes of clothes, and the multiple changes of clothes, and the trying to figure out what goes with what, and the time all spent in shopping and trying to find those things, compared to the amount of time that is spent looking at the inner person, the person that can't be seen when you look in the mirror, but is behind the person in the mirror, within the person in the mirror. How much time and effort goes into looking and primping the inner person? That is Paul's emphasis here, that he wants Timothy to share with those with whom he is working. And if Paul wanted the young man Timothy to address this subject in that era back then, why in the world would we think that this isn't a subject for us to consider as well? Especially in contrast to what we were reading in Proverbs, that there is such a thing called the attire of a harlot. And like I said, that may vary from generation to generation as to what we might stereotypically associate with those who are advertising themselves. But let's face it, in our culture, we've got a pretty good idea of when a woman is advertising herself. The media shows us these things on a continual basis. Advertisers use these styles so as to attract the attention of men who are buyers, so that we will then unload our pockets because we have been interested in the product. Now, Peter has something to say about this, in addition to what Paul told Timothy here. And we've read right on past this the other night, but I want to stop and take note of it this evening in this context. 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 3, where Peter says here, "Do not let your beauty be the outward adorning of arranging the hair, of wearing gold, or of putting on fine apparel, but let it be the hidden person of the heart with the incorruptible ornament of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God." So Peter also calls for purity. That's what he said that your husbands will observe, even your unbelieving husbands, in verse 2, when they observe your chaste conduct or pure conduct accompanied by fear. So he calls for purity, and he makes immediate application to adornment. Now, I think a lot of times we have a tendency to just kind of downplay adornment, clothing, because it's external. And we know, intellectually, spiritually, that God is mostly concerned with the inner man, and there is no doubt about that. But God is not mocked. And He knows that the outer person oftentimes is a reflection of the inner person. And therefore, that is why Paul and Peter both address the outer person so as to emphasize, to refocus attention on what is most important to God, and that is the inner person. It is clear that both scripturally, as we've in the text that we've read and others that we could, and currently in our own culture, that what we wear can indeed be a form of communication. We communicate something about ourselves by what we wear. And far less time and money should be spent on primping the outer person and far more on the inner person. Our society is very much concerned with fashion, being in, being sexy. It's unbelievable to me how often we use that word and what we use it for. Sexy. Cars are sexy. Copiers are sexy. I mean, you've seen the copy. No, maybe you haven't, but the magazines I get, there's a copier, and then there's this pretty young thing sitting next to it. What does she have to do with the copier? Virtually nothing, but it gets your attention. And what are women communicating to men and boys, young, impressionable boys, when they dress themselves so as to catch that second glance? Godly women, let me suggest to you, have no desire to use their bodies to attract anyone other than their husbands. But harlots do, because that's their job. If they don't do a good job in advertising themselves, they're going to go out of business. We should not be modeling ourselves after the harlots of the world. I know that is harsh terminology, so I said it softly. You know I can yell. I can be loud. I've been told I'm loud. I've scared little children. But I said it softly so that we understand that God, when He uses these words, is trying to convey an image to us that is harsh, that is blunt, that is understandable, so that we will make the application. Modesty seems to be a lost art in our culture. And it is interesting to me that even worldly women are beginning to see that and observe that. Women know that men are visually turned on and what they are turned on by. Let me say mature women are, experienced women are, harlots certainly are. If they weren't, they would go out of business. Godly women do not exploit this information. Harlots do. You see the difference? There's information there. There are basic facts about human beings, about the genders and their differences, and all of these people may be aware of this information. Some exploit that for their own gain and benefit. Others are careful with that power. And if some women are ignorant of this ability that they have and it just don't know that they have it, then older women need, as we've already been emphasizing from Titus chapter 2, older women need to train the younger women on the proper use of this powerful tool that you have, ladies. And that's why Paul tells Titus to teach the older women, to teach the younger women, to love their husbands and to be chaste, that is pure and discreet. But I'm afraid that this is a generational thing. Oftentimes, the younger generation looks at the older women, they look at how the older women are dressing, they go, I don't want to dress like that. And they have no interest in what the older women have to say on this subject, forgetting, as I emphasized last night, that these old, wrinkled generation were young and vibrant like you were. And they know more than you do, because they have experienced life longer than you have. And older women, I'm afraid, are intimidated by the younger women, assuming that they'll just write them off. I am so glad that these studies are going to take place on Thursday nights between the older men and the younger men. This will be good. And let me suggest to you that the same needs to be done for the women in whatever context that that can be done. And certainly, mothers to daughters. Fathers to daughters. This woman, this seductress that we're reading about in Proverbs chapter 7, we're not only told she wore the attire of a harlot, but that she had a crafty heart. And this addresses her attitudes and the intentions that she had, which are ultimately to seduce and accomplish her own selfish purposes for whatever ends. Now, I do not mean to suggest that women are always or even usually the seducers and that men are their victims. Proverbs is the one that is using this scenario. I am just using the scenario that the Proverbs writer is using. I'm following that. Obviously, either sex can play the role of a seducer. But here we're told in this particular scenario that we're reading about in Proverbs chapter 7 that she is shameless. She is aggressive. She is loud and rebellious. In contrast to that godly woman that we just read about in 1 Peter chapter 3 with a meek and quiet spirit. She's the antithesis of that here in Proverbs chapter 7. Godly women, as we've been emphasizing throughout this week and looking at Ephesians chapter 5, are called upon to be submissive to their husbands. Submissive is not what this woman was that we read about in Proverbs chapter 7. And again, as I've noted already this week, our society does not encourage this in women. It is not training it in our schools. If it's going to be a characteristic and a quality of the inner adornment of our ladies, of our young women, it is going to have to be taught by us. It is going to have to be taught by those who trust the Word of God. We cannot leave it to the culture. The culture will not teach this. Here we're told in Proverbs chapter 7 and verse 11 specifically, after telling us that she was loud and rebellious, we're told that her feet would not stay at home. Verse 11. That's not a condemnation, by the way, of women who go outside the four walls of their house. But this is a woman who is not, obviously not content in her role as a wife to her husband who has gone on a long journey. The story isn't about the husband who's gone on a long journey. That's just a piece of information that helps to set the stage. Don't take the tangent. Don't ask the question, well, maybe he shouldn't have been gone. Maybe. It's a fictional story. Okay? We're not going to chase that tangent. The Proverbs writer doesn't chase that tangent. That isn't material to the subject we're talking about. It is very possible that he shouldn't have been gone. But maybe he should have. The point simply is she was not content in her role as a wife. This is a woman, verse 12, who is looking for trouble. And so in verse 13, we're told she catches him and kisses him. And it would take a strong man to resist that kind of aggression, especially if she's beautiful. Oh no, if she is not appealing to the guy will scream like a girl and run. He's not interested. But if she is at all attractive to him, based on the outward person, because he certainly doesn't know her heart, then to resist that, that would be very difficult. Oh, you're familiar, though. It's great that we have a wonderful example of this in Genesis chapter 39. And that reference alone probably informs you who we're going to talk about here just for a few minutes. Genesis 39, beginning with verse 7. Now it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph. And she said, lie with me. But he refused. And said to his master's wife, look, my master does not know what is with me in the house, and he has committed all that he has to my hand. There is no one greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? So it was, as she spoke to Joseph day by day, that he did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her. But it happened about this time when Joseph went into the house to do his work and none of the men of the house was inside that she caught him by the garment saying, lie with me. But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. And so it was when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and fled outside that she called the men of her house and spoke to them, saying, see, he has brought into us a Hebrew to mock us. He came to me to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And it happened when he heard that I lifted my voice and cried out that he left his garment with me and fled and went outside. So she kept his garment with her until his master came home. And you probably know the rest of the story. Potiphar's wife was one of these women that we're reading about in Proverbs chapter 7. But thankfully, we have the positive example of Joseph, don't we, young men? The positive example of Joseph. And it's an example that needs to be looked into in more depth and more detail than I'm going to take at this moment right now. And I hope that you will do that. Because he is a fantastic example of exactly what we need to be doing. He did what was right, and he suffered for it. And that is our calling, brethren. Remember 1 Peter chapter 2? To this you have been called. We do what's right, and we suffer for it. Because that's what Jesus did. He did what was right, and he suffered for it. And look at the good that it accomplished. Imagine the good it will accomplish when we do what is right, even if we suffer for it. This crafty-hearted seductress that we read about here, we're told, is a temptress. We're told that with an impudent face, that word impudent means bold or shameless disregard. She doesn't care. With an impudent face, she invites him to share with her in her peace offerings, verse 14 of Proverbs 7. And we may miss that. We may read right over that. Not really, I don't get what that is exactly. She's inviting him up to her place to eat. Yeah. She's performed her sacrificial duties. She wants to share with him in that feast. She's playing to all of his appetites. And men like to eat. And she knows it. She knows what men like. And there's nothing wrong with knowing what men like. It's what do you do with that information? Do you flaunt it with an impudent face? Or do you guard it and you protect the hearts of those who may be caused to stumble? She flatters him here by saying that he's the one that she has been looking for. Beware of flattery. No matter who the source is, beware of flattery. She makes clear her intentions by describing her bed and boldly invites him to spend the night taking their fill of love and delighting one another. They were going to have a good time. And who doesn't like a good time? Indeed, tempting. So we have the seductress. That's one of our characters. But then we have a man lacking understanding. That's what we're told there in verse 7. I saw among the simple, I perceived among the youths, a young man devoid of understanding. Perhaps your translation puts it a little bit different. But basically the idea of someone who is naive. Now, men, especially young men, do not readily admit to being ignorant or naive. We think we know it all. We have it under control. This man, as he is pictured here, is not strolling down the street saying, "Oh, I am an ignoramus, simple as can be." That's not how he would identify himself. What young man perceives himself as a total ignoramus? Very, very few. Most likely he's confident. He knows what he's doing, and he is sure that he is in control. And that makes his situation even more dangerous. Because he doesn't realize that he isn't in as much control as he thinks he is. The Hebrew word for simple here means to be a silly person, one easily persuaded and enticed. In verses 21 and 22, let's read those again of that chapter. With her enticing speech, she caused him to yield. With her flattering lips, she seduced him. Immediately he went after her as an ox goes to the slaughter. You've heard the phrase, dumb as an ox. Now you know the context from which it is taken. With just a little flattery, with just a little flirtatious wink, a little exposure of the leg, the hip, the breast, and the dumb ox is off to the slaughterhouse. Legend has it, one vigilant mother of sons who, when observing her sons falling all over themselves, over the attentions or the outward beauty of some girl who happened to pass them by, would only have to moo at them to make her point. It probably meant something like, mop up the pool of drool at your feet and wipe that stupid look off of your face. No, she was not opposed to her son's interests in godly women, but she didn't appreciate having sons who behaved like dumb oxen. And the boys will be boys. Rationalization is an excuse for lazy parents. And unless corrected, those boys will just grow up to be big boys. And they'll stay boys. Now, often this word that is translated simple here is used to imply, I thought this was interesting, as the New International Standard Bible Encyclopedia says, self-destructive stupidity. Wow. Proverbs chapter 14. In Proverbs chapter 14 and verse 15. The simple, there's our word again. The simple believes every word, but the prudent man considers well his steps. A wise man fears and departs from evil, but a fool rages and is self-confident. He who is quick-tempered acts foolishly, and a man of wicked intentions is hated. The simple inherit folly, but the prudent are crowned with knowledge. This is a characteristic that we don't want to have in any of our areas of life. But as we see in Proverbs chapter 7, it can be quite detrimental. Or in Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 3. A prudent man foresees evil and hides himself, but the simple pass on and are punished. Now again, the point of this lesson is not that only men are stupid and naive. Women are capable in their silly giddiness to behave in equally stupid ways and become victims of a seducer. Nevertheless, the stereotypes that the Proverbs writer uses here are not at all unfair. They're common. And typically, men are more easily and quickly drawn away by what they see and require very little more than just something that arouses them with their eyes, whereas women typically must form some sort of attachment first before they can be seduced. It may not be a realistic attachment. It may be a fantasy attachment. But nevertheless, that has to be formed before they will be seduced. For guys, it doesn't take that much. And we also see, as we look at this man, besides the fact that he is naive, he is careless. Verse 8 says he passes along the street near her corner and he takes the path to her house. He flirts with danger. Again, now stereotypically, men are risk takers, more so than women. Which positively, by the way, makes them bold. It makes them protective. It makes them good leadership material. But it also makes them susceptible to thinking way too highly of themselves than they ought to. And putting themselves, therefore, in spiritually dangerous situations. In this case, in this particular scenario that we have in Proverbs chapter 7, he is venturing where he should not go. He is putting himself in a challenging and tempting situation, believing that he can handle whatever comes along. And he's a fool. As we've already noted from 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 18, flee sexual immorality. That's what the godly man will do. Flee sexual immorality. And fleeing does not include passing along the street near her corner and taking the path to her house. That is not fleeing. And technically, you might think that it's safe and that you're under control as long as you don't go all the way. But to think that way is naive, it is foolish, it is stupid, and it's sin long before you get there. It's interesting as we read the narrative here in verse 9, it's in the twilight, in the evening, in the black and dark night. Obviously, he thinks he can't be seen. He doesn't know that he's being watched by the narrator, in this case, God. Men, that's a good test for us. Is this something we would want others to know? If we're married men, do we want our wives to know that we're engaged in whatever activity? We're trying to judge whether or not we should be doing this. Or if we're not married yet, would we want our sisters to know, or would we want our mother to know, or our aunts to know? Think about these kinds of things before you think you're strong enough to handle the situation. Or as Isaiah puts it, in Isaiah chapter 29 and verse 15, "Woe to those who seek deep to hide their counsel far from the Lord, and their works are in the dark. They say, 'Who sees us and who knows us?'" And they say those things because they're foolish, they're naive. People do their deeds under the cover of darkness, thinking nobody sees. And ironically, it is that same cover of darkness that causes even more stumbling. What else do you do in the dark except stumble more? So we have our seductress and we have a man lacking understanding. You put those two together, a seductress and a man lacking understanding, and the equation adds up to death. Proverbs chapter 7, let's continue reading at verse 24. "Now therefore listen to me, my children. Pay attention to the words of my mouth. Do not let your heart turn aside to her ways. Do not stray into her paths. For she has cast down many wounded, and all who were slain by her were strong men. Her house is the way to hell, descending to the chambers of death." A seductress or a seducer plus a simpleton equals death and destruction. We have the phrase, "An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure." And that needs to be applied in these kinds of scenarios every bit as much. So, what should you do? If you're naive, which you are if you're young, what should you do? It's a deadly combination. Well, here's what you should do. You should listen. Proverbs chapter 6 and verse 20. Proverbs chapter 6, verse 20. "My son, keep your father's command and do not forsake the law of your mother. Bind them continually on your heart. Tie them around your neck. When you roam, they will lead you. When you sleep, they will keep you. And when you awake, they will speak with you. For the commandment is a lamp, and the law is light. Reproofs of instruction are the way of life, to keep you from the evil woman, from the flattering tongue of a seductress." Or, as he says in Proverbs chapter 7, beginning with verse 1, "My son, keep my words and treasure my commands within you. Keep my commands and live, and my law as the apple of your eye. Bind them on your fingers. Write them on the tablet of your heart. Say to wisdom, 'You are my sister,' and call understanding your nearest kin, that they may keep you from the immoral woman, from the seductress who flatters with her words." Listen. Pay attention. And don't stray into her paths. Verse 25, going back to Proverbs chapter 6. "Do not lust after her beauty in your heart, nor let her allure you with her eyelids. For by means of a harlot, a man is reduced to a crust of bread, and an adulteress will prey upon his precious life." Indeed, he goes on to say, "Can a man take fire into his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Can one walk on hot coals and his feet not be seared? So is he who goes into his neighbor's wife. Whoever touches her shall not be innocent." We're playing with fire here. But so often, what is temptation but that which we crawl slowly away from in the hopes that it will overtake us? So that we can say, "I was trying to get away, but I was just overcome." And we're fooling ourselves. We tempt ourselves by the bad choices that we make. We intentionally put ourselves in risky situations, hoping just to get a glimpse of that which we should not, thinking we can handle it. It's research. And we pass along the street near her corner. We page through the magazine. We surf the channels. We surf the internet. And then suddenly, she catches us like a bolt of lightning, and her image is indelibly imprinted into our heads, and she may never leave, young men. She may be with you the rest of your life. And not because you won't try to get rid of her, but because she has been imprinted into your memory bank. And parents, that's why we are diligent, vigilant on these kinds of matters. Because what we see imprints. We like that when it's things we want to remember. But when it's things we don't want to remember, things we shouldn't be doing, it just wells back up within us through the years as guilt, knowing good and well that we should not have been involved, that we should not have passed along the street near her corner. And we need to learn. In Proverbs chapter 5, in verse 3, "For the lips of an immoral woman drip honey, and her mouth is smoother than oil. But in the end, she is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death. Her steps lay hold of hell. Unless you ponder her path of life, her ways are unstable. You do not know them. Therefore, hear me now, my children, and do not depart from the words of my mouth. Remove your way far from her, and do not go near the door of her house, lest you give your honor to others and your years to the cruel one." Ooh, such sound advice. In verse 20, "For why should you, my son, be enraptured by an immoral woman and be embraced in the arms of a seductress? For the ways of man are before the eyes of the Lord, and he ponders all his paths. His own iniquities entrap the wicked man, and he is caught in the cords of his sin. He shall die for lack of instruction, and in the greatness of his folly, he shall go astray." Don't fall into the trap. Ask for help. Ask for practical instruction. Ask those with experience, not your peers. Ask those who are older than you. Ask those who have been successful, because no doubt they have had their trials in this area as well. Because keep this in mind, as we already read. Many are the victims she has brought down. Her slain are a mighty throng. Don't be ignorant. Don't be naive. And don't be overconfident. Very quickly, turn to Proverbs chapter 9. There are two women vying for our attention, people. Two women who are vying for our attention. Verse 1, beginning of Proverbs chapter 9. "Wisdom has built her house. She has hewn out her seven pillars. She has slaughtered her meat. She has mixed her wine. She has also furnished her table. She has set out her maidens. She cries out from the highest places of the city, 'Whoever is simple, let him turn in here. As for him who lacks understanding, she says to him, Come, eat of my bread and drink of the wine which I have mixed. Forsake foolishness and live and go in the way of understanding.'" And then jump on down to verse 10. "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. For by me your days will be multiplied, and years of life will be added to you. If you are wise, you are wise for yourself. And if you scoff, you alone will bear it. Wisdom is personified here for us. She's like a mother. She's like a grandmother. She's like a sister. She's like an aunt, providing for us the fear of the Lord and offering us years of life. She calls upon us to forsake all that foolishness and come on in and have some milk and cookies of purity. But then there's another woman described here, verse 13. A foolish woman is clamorous. She is simple and knows nothing. For she sits at the door of her house on a seat by the highest places of the city to call to those who pass by, who go straight on their way. Whoever is simple, let him turn in here. And as for him who lacks understanding, she says to him, stolen water is sweet, and bread eaten in secret is pleasant. But he does not know that the dead are there, and that her guests are in the depths of hell. So folly is also personified as a woman who calls and invites us to turn to her for understanding. And like a seductress, she glamorizes forbidden pleasures, and many, many, many fall for her allurement, not knowing that it is a passing, temporary, fleeting pleasure that ultimately leads to death. Ladies, which of these two women do you model yourselves after? In the way that you adorn your heart and the way that you adorn your body. Which of these two do we want our daughters to be like? And which of these two do we want our sons to find instruction from? If you have fallen prey to the seduction of folly, the end is death. But the good news is that Jesus has died to rescue you from her clutches. And wisdom, she still invites you to know the fear of the Lord. And if we can help you to that end, let us know. All together we stand and sing.
Have you been to Jesus for the